Secretary of State Antony Blinken is back in the Middle East working to prevent the conflict between Israel and Hamas from expanding into a wider war.
That could really open the gates of hell in the entire region.
I'm Carolyn Beeler. The Catholic faith has deep roots in Nicaragua, but the government there is now arresting members of the Catholic clergy.
We have never faced, as a country, an episode of such massive persecution of the church.
And an American biotech company will not sell DNA kits in Tibet anymore because of concerns about how they're being used.
This is mass DNA collection that is going on outside of any kind of police casework.
And as a private company heads to the moon, who does the lunar surface actually belong to? Those stories and more ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. Thanks for starting your week with us. It's an urgent mission with lots of stops in Turkey, Greece, Jordan, Qatar, the United Arab Emirates, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. Those are the stops for Secretary of State Antony Blinken on his latest round of shuttle diplomacy aimed at preventing the Israel-Hamas war from spreading. Here to help us understand what's at stake with Blinken's fourth Middle East visit in 3 months is Bilal Saab. He directs the Defense and Security Program at the Middle East Institute in Washington. Bilal, what is at the very top of the Secretary's agenda on this trip?
We don't really have to guess what the top priority here is. It really centers on preventing this conflict from turning into a wider war. So de-escalation is the name of the game right now.
So what are the key takeaways or things he might want to be able to come away with when he returns to Washington?
Yeah, I mean, you can already see the challenges he's had to face in convincing the Israelis to abide by international law and respect American preferences, which, as we just discussed, you know, will center on the prevention of a wider war. But you can't help but see that there's an inherent paradox in his efforts to achieve his own aims. We continue to supply Israel with weapons, and we have vetoed the UN resolution calling for a ceasefire. So it seems like we are undercutting our own diplomatic efforts, and we don't need Israel to do that.
So the U.S. has, of course, different relationships with each of the countries that Blinken is visiting. Which nations are most closely aligned or standing closest to the U.S. at this stage in the conflict?
Well, that's a good question. I would suppose the Qataris, given the serious diplomatic role that they're playing in terms of mediation, given the channel of communication that they have with Hamas. Obviously, Hamas leadership, also part of it, resides in Doha. But boy, the gaps are significant still. The Arabs are focusing on ceasefire, on shots no longer getting fired so that actually diplomacy could be pursued. But, you know, the United States still, once again, is very much hesitant to push the Israelis, to apply pressure on the Israelis to go for a ceasefire. And this is where, you know, we're stuck.
So where at this point does Washington have the most leverage? It sounds like you're saying there is very limited leverage in Israel. Is Qatar a place that the U.S. has more leverage?
Well, it's actually not true that there's no leverage. We do have plenty of leverage with the Israelis, given the fact that they cannot wage this entire military campaign without U.S. armament.
Sure.
And U.S. financial assistance. The bigger question, of course, is whether the United States wants to exercise that leverage. And look, I'm not saying that suspending the aid to Israel or voting at the UN differently will immediately change Israeli behavior, but I guess we will not know until the U.S. tries. So once again, it's a question of whether the United States wants to exercise leverage. And so far, it has shown that it doesn't want to because it understands it has a political cost at home at a time of re-election for President Biden.
I would imagine, though, there is a difference between the statements coming out of Blinken and the administration publicly and then what's happening in closed-door meetings. So you said that it doesn't look like the U.S. is trying to use that influence. But are they, perhaps? Is Blinken perhaps trying to exert leverage behind closed doors?
I find it hard to believe, frankly. What's also striking about this trip is that it doesn't really have an ambitious set of goals or specific large-scale initiative. It's all based on conversations and consultations, which are important. Don't get me wrong. I'm not undermining those. But it's as if the United States is some average or regular power. It's all still in the exploration phase, not in the problem-solving phase. Maybe that's the way to go. But I still remain convinced that, you know, absent U.S. leadership backed by creative and serious diplomacy, those regional powers that you just talked about will not be able to do anything on their own. I mean, those countries are still not at a point where they can resolve conflicts or stop wars independently of the United States.
Of course, the U.S. has this close relationship with Israel, but the two countries' views on this conflict have diverged a lot. Just how different are they right now?
The United States certainly has an interest in de-escalation, doesn't want to see this war spiraling out of control and spilling over into Lebanon. And also there's a gap on the issue of civilian casualties, of course. We have been pressing the Israelis from soon after the October 7 attack about reducing civilian casualties, allowing humanitarian assistance in greater amounts. This is where those differences are. I think they're, you know, if you want to call them tactical differences, but they still are very significant in the eyes of the international community.
Is this conflict and the increasingly divergent views on it from Israel and the U.S. driving these two longtime allies apart at all?
No, I don't think so. I think that would be an exaggeration. There have been always political tensions between Israel and the United States whenever Israel waged large-scale campaigns in the region. But ultimately, you know, they will find a common ground. There will be some kind of a consensus on the way forward. It just takes a matter of time. This time around, you have to remember that Israel suffered a historic and spectacular terrorist attacks at the hands of Hamas. So you can imagine that the tensions are a little bit higher than usual. But ultimately, I do not think that they would lead to rupture in relations or significant tensions that would lead to any kind of adjustment in the relationship. I just don't see that.
Mm. The Israel-Hamas war has now entered its fourth month, and the devastation just keeps mounting. The Hamas-run Gaza Health Ministry puts the overall death toll in the territory since early October at more than 22,700 people. What is the end game as you see it?
It's hard to really see an end game materializing very soon, given the maximalist objectives of the Israelis, which is the destruction of Hamas, the de-radicalization of Palestinian society. You know, such lofty goals that really find very hard to see how their application is going to happen anytime soon. As long as Israel sticks to these objectives, you're going to continue to see that death toll mount and mount. And I hope that this is the whole point of American diplomacy, is to try to apply pressure on the Israelis to adjust the goalposts, to adjust their war objectives. And you're seeing some of that happening in practical terms, given that they're now calling it the third phase of operations, which supposedly is supposed to be more surgical. But that does not preclude, that does not rule out the fact that the Israelis might still entertain high-intensity combat operations if they find, you know, Hamas senior operatives, they have intelligence on them, and they have to strike them, even though that operative would be residing, you know, below a school or another civilian target that might lead to civilian casualties. So on paper, the next phase might be a little bit less deadly, but in reality, I mean, Israel is going to act if they see an intelligence target that would further their war objectives and continue to try to decapitate Hamas leadership.
Bilal Saab directs the Defense and Security Program at the Middle East Institute in Washington. He's been speaking with us about U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken's latest round of shuttle diplomacy in the Middle East. Thanks a lot.
It's my pleasure.
The Israeli military, as we just heard, says it is shifting its campaign in Gaza toward a more targeted phase of fighting Hamas. But some of the reports coming out of the Palestinian territory suggest that life is not getting any easier for the civilian population. The World Health Organization said it had to cancel another delivery of medical aid into northern Gaza because of heavy bombardment. The World's Shirin Jafari has more on what life has been like for people in the Gaza Strip.
A father's last goodbye to his son. Waal Dahdou, a reporter with the Al Jazeera network, stands over the body of 27-year-old Hamza. He was reportedly killed in an Israeli airstrike. Wearing his blue body armor with the word press marked on it, Dahdou holds back tears. This is our fate, he says, as others join to comfort him. This is not the first time Dahdou has lost family members. In October, his wife, son, daughter, and grandson were killed in another Israeli attack. He has lost several other relatives and colleagues. In Gaza, the grief just seems to pile up. For those who manage to somehow survive, life is nothing short of misery.
These are some of the tents that have been build.
Nadine Abdel-Latif posts regularly on social media from Gaza. In this Instagram video, she gives a tour of the camp for displaced people and one of the tents that they live in.
You can see that it's wrapped around plastic bags and it's very thin.
The plastic cover doesn't keep the rain and cold out, she says. Abdel-Latif pleads for more assistance to come into Gaza. But aid delivery has been painfully slow. That's according to U.S. Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland, who visited the Gaza-Egypt border last Friday. He spoke on CBS's Face the Nation yesterday.
Many items that should be allowed to go into Gaza, water sort of filtration systems, other systems like that, were in a warehouse of rejected items that we visited.
Israeli inspectors have also rejected some tents and medical kits, aid workers told the senator, because they say Hamas could use them for military purposes. Van Hollen, who was visiting the area along with Senator Jeff Merkley of Oregon, says the aid delivery needs to be faster.
Israeli screening sites are only operating on like an 8-hour-a-day schedule, taking some days off. This is a 24/7 humanitarian crisis.
The destruction of Gaza is so widespread that it can be seen from space.
It's just it's a different landscape than it was before this aerial bombardment. When we look at the raw data, we can just see the kind of the urban regions being chewed away.
Corey Scher is a PhD student at the City University of New York. He and Jamin Van Den Hoek of Oregon State University have been looking at satellite imagery of Gaza since the war began. They say the enclave has changed color and texture compared to pre-war images. The two study damages in conflict zones, and they say the speed and intensity of the destruction in Gaza is unlike anything they have ever seen. Here's Van Den Hoek.
There are certainly areas, whole blocks, whole apartment buildings that have been totally destroyed. And if they weren't bombed, there have been bulldozer campaigns where they bulldoze structures, push them down.
Reconstruction will take years, Scher says, and there will be many challenges, starting with the cleanup of tons of rubble left from the bombardments. Even when the war ends, he says, Gaza will likely see its effects for years to come. For the world, I'm Shireen Jafari.
In the north of Israel, the cross-border fighting between Hezbollah and Israel has intensified. Israel killed an elite Hezbollah commander in an airstrike today. That's after a Hamas leader was killed in Lebanon last week. Israel is also suspected in that killing. Ahead this hour, how the militant group Hezbollah rose to power in Lebanon. Germany and soccer fans everywhere are mourning one of the greats today, soccer icon Franz Beckenbauer. He won the World Cup both as a player and a coach and became one of Germany's most beloved personalities with his easygoing charm. His family announced he had died at the age of 78. Beckenbauer, or the Kaiser as he was known, was one of German soccer's central figures. As a player, he redefined the role of a defender on the pitch and was captain of the West German team that won the World Cup in 1974. Fast forward to 1990, the Berlin Wall had just been toppled, and Beckenbauer was then the coach of the West German squad. They won the World Cup again that year, a moment that was hugely symbolic for a country that was just beginning to reunite. The German Soccer Federation president said today, "The Kaiser was one of the best players our sport has ever seen." Franz Beckenbauer leaves a great legacy for the federation and soccer as a whole. You're listening to The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. You're listening to The World. The government in Nicaragua is intensifying its crackdown on the Catholic Church. Over the last few weeks, more than a dozen priests and bishops have been arrested or expelled from the country. Several Catholic institutions have been shut down as well. As The World's Tibisa Isaiah reports, the situation in Nicaragua is setting off alarms at the Vatican.
The majority of Nicaraguans identify as Catholic, and that includes President Daniel Ortega.
Yo soy revolucionario gracias a Cristo. Por Cristo me hice revolucionario.
I'm a revolutionary thanks to Christ. Christ is in my heart, he said in a rally last year. but his relationship with the Catholic Church has been deteriorating for some time. For 16 years, Ortega has held on to power through highly questionable elections. Many Nicaraguans consider him a dictator, along with a number of foreign governments and the Pope.
Tipo de dictaduras groseras.
In March of last year, Pope Francis compared Ortega's government to a communist or a fascist dictatorship.
Es una dictadura, la dictadura perfecta.
Ortega pushed back and said the Catholic Church was, quote, the perfect dictatorship.
¿Quién elige al Papa, los cardenales, cuántos votos? ¿Quién se los da?
Who elects the Pope? Who elects the cardinals? How many votes do they get? He told State TV. This animosity goes back to 2018. This is when Nicaraguans took to the streets to protest austerity measures and pension reforms. Government forces cracked down, attacking protesters. Many were killed. The country's Catholic leaders said they stood with the people. And since then, priests and bishops who criticize Ortega have been harassed, exiled, imprisoned, and tortured. The regime has also shut down hundreds of Catholic institutions.
The Catholic Church in Nicaragua is deeply linked to our identity, and we have never faced, as a country, an episode of such massive persecution of the Church.
Félix Maradiaga is a pro-democracy activist from Nicaragua. He says the main goal of the government's crackdown is not to completely dismantle the Catholic Church, but to control it. Something similar to what happened in communist regimes like Cuba or China.
The Communist Party of China, they had this Department of Religious Affairs that basically dictates and creates censorships of what can be said. Some years ago, the Vatican was forced basically to accept that arrangement in order to keep the Catholic Church within China.
But Victor Gaetan, an expert on Vatican diplomacy, said this model is unlikely to be replicated in Nicaragua because the great majority of its citizens are Catholic.
The level of suppression that the regime would have to exercise will be so unacceptable and so overwhelming that I don't foresee it.
He says the Vatican has ways of defending the Catholic Church when it's under attack from authoritarian governments.
A common Vatican strategy, especially under an autocratic regime, is to maintain a presence and resist being swallowed, quietly working to limit the state's most aggressive tactics.
He says the historic lesson is that the Church has always survived dictatorships. During his annual New Year's Day Mass, the Pope expressed concern about what's going on in Nicaragua.
Seguo con preocupazione quanto sta avvenendo in Nicaragua.
He said he hopes to engage in dialogue with the government and invited everyone to pray for Nicaragua. For the world, I'm Tibisa Isaiah.
An American biotech company has agreed to stop selling DNA identification kits and equipment in Tibet. This follows criticism from human rights groups that goes back a few years about how the DNA kits from Thermo Fisher were being used. Critics argue that the Chinese government collects troves of information to profile and control people in Tibet. A government report from China said that DNA collection is for public security officials to, quote, effectively crack down on illegal and criminal elements. To understand what's called biometric profiling, we called up Emil Dirks. He's a researcher at Citizen Lab, a research institute at the University of Toronto, and he put together an early report about DNA collection in Tibet. Let's start with Thermo Fisher here, Emil. What's behind the company's decision to stop selling this technology in Tibet?
Credit has to go to Tibetan groups, specifically Students for Free Tibet, which for more than a year have been putting a pressure campaign on Thermo Fisher to stop selling human identification equipment to police in Tibet. And it was in part informed by the work of Human Rights Watch, Yves Moreau, a researcher who focuses on bioethics, and the work that I did through the Citizen Lab, which was looking at mass DNA collection by police in Tibet over the last 2 years.
So this is DNA gathering and then sequencing equipment, I understand. What information does this technology give the Chinese government, and how do people fear it will be used?
So this is mass DNA collection that is going on outside of any kind of police casework. Police are going into communities, going into schools, homes, places of worship, and collecting DNA from men, women, and children, which is then being stored in police-run databases. The police in Tibet have provided a range of reasons why they're doing this. They claim that it could be for the purpose of cracking down on crime, dealing with the problem of missing or trafficked individuals, maintaining social stability. But what's also clear is the police in Tibet have quite a horrendous record of human rights abuses within that region. And so for the police to be going in and conducting a mass biometric surveillance program targeting members of the Tibetan community, it's quite worrying. Mass DNA collection is one more reminder that the people of Tibet have that they are under the constant watch and monitoring of the state. So it's really quite a gross violation of the right to individual privacy that people within that region should enjoy.
So Thermo Fisher has agreed to stop selling DNA identification kits in Tibet, but is it selling to the Chinese government elsewhere? And is there a concern that technology could then work its way into Tibet?
Well, we know that Thermo Fisher makes a lot of its sales in the Chinese market, and that they make a lot of sales to public security bureaus across China, not just in Tibet, not just in Xinjiang, but in a range of areas. We know that the Ministry of Public Security has, at least since the late 2010s, been engaging in a program of mass DNA collection targeting men and boys across China, outside of Tibet and Xinjiang. And based on publicly available procurement documents, it's clear that Thermo Fisher equipment has been used for the purpose of this program. While Thermo Fisher has agreed to stop selling kits and equipment within the Tibet Autonomous Region, much as it agreed to do so in Xinjiang in 2019, there's no indication that they have ceased to make sales to public security bureaus outside of Tibet or outside of Xinjiang. And it's a reminder, I believe, to Chinese citizens that they are under constant surveillance.
And I'll note here that we reached out to Thermo Fisher about this story, but they hadn't replied before we went to air. Emil Dirks is with Citizen Lab, a research institute at the University of Toronto. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
You're with The World. In Greenland, an Inuit tattooing tradition was largely erased by colonial rulers. Now is making a comeback.
They see themselves in the mirror after getting tattooed, and they are kind of saying, like, I see me, I recognize me, I was supposed to have looked like this the whole time.
That story ahead on The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. This is The World. We're a co-production of GBH in Boston and PRX. In southern Lebanon today, a senior Hezbollah commander was killed in a suspected Israeli missile attack. The incident is one of the latest in a series of back-and-forth attacks between Hezbollah and the Israeli military. And it is sure to add to worries about the war in the Middle East expanding. Hezbollah is the most powerful military force in Lebanon. It's supported by Iran and has thousands of rockets capable of hitting targets all across Israel. An Israeli government spokesman said today that Hezbollah troops must move north, away from Lebanon's southern border with Israel. If not, he said the Israeli military will make them relocate. Back in October, we sent Rebecca Collard to report on the history of Hezbollah. Here's Rebecca's report about how the group went from being a ragtag militia to a major political, economic, and military force in Lebanon.
In 1982, during Lebanon's civil war, Hezbollah was founded with the help of Iran's Revolutionary Guard. The intention was to end Israel's almost two-decade-long occupation of South Lebanon. Israel had invaded in order to root out Palestinian militants. That same year, Hiyam Harb gave birth to her first child in a shelter in Beirut. Just 22 years old and pregnant, she had fled Israel's invasion of South Lebanon and was now living in a crowded displacement center. The shelter caught fire, she says. I held my baby daughter in my hands. She started choking on the smoke. But the bombing of Beirut intensified and Harb decided to go back to the south. There, she saw the early days of Hezbollah as a militia. She describes how Hezbollah attacked Israeli soldiers from what she calls under the table. Then Hezbollah had just hundreds of fighters and simple explosives and weapons. In 1985, Hezbollah officially released its manifesto, called an open letter to the oppressed in Lebanon and the world, promising to push Western forces out of Lebanon, end colonial presence, and what it calls the Zionist occupation of Palestine. In 1989, the Ta'if Accords ended Lebanon's 15-year civil war. All the country's militia were forced to disarm, but Israel still occupied South Lebanon, and Hezbollah, the resistance, was allowed to keep their weapons. Bashir Sadeh is with the University of Stirling and has written a book on Hezbollah.
By the end of the 90s and the end of the civil war in Lebanon, or the various wars in Lebanon, Hezbollah becomes a, you know, one of the political forces to be reckoned with. In 92, they enter parliament after a huge existential dilemma. Should we be in the system or outside the system?
In the year 2000, Israeli troops left Lebanon. Hassan Nasrallah gave a speech telling Palestinians they could also drive Israel out of their lands with true and honest resistance. Hiyam Harb, who had lived under the Israeli occupation, describes its end, being able to visit villages she hadn't seen in almost two decades, and the end of the bombings and raids she had become so used to, or at least she thought. In 2006, Hezbollah captured Israeli soldiers in a cross-border raid, setting off a month-long war that killed at least 1,100 Lebanese and more than 150 Israelis. It left swaths of South Lebanon in ruin, including Harb's house. She says it was Hezbollah that helped her rebuild. By then, her son had joined the group. I support the resistance, and I support my son joining the resistance, she says. While the U.S. and other Western states designate Hezbollah a terrorist organization, for Harb, they are her protectors and saviors. Without the resistance, we wouldn't be living in South Lebanon, she says.
So 2006 was hailed as a victory for most people, including people who were not really fond of Hezbollah. It was a big thing for the Arab streets, for everything. I mean, you know, 2006 was a huge landmark for the party.
Hezbollah is a volunteer force, but it has proved more disciplined than many of the region's national armies. Experts estimate Hezbollah may have some 150,000 missiles in its arsenal and as many as 60,000 fighters, many with experience fighting ISIS and other militant groups in Syria on the side of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. And alongside Hezbollah's military might and ideology of resistance, there is something else that fosters loyalty. At the entrance to a supermarket in South Beirut, there are photos of Israeli soldiers crying next to Lebanese holding the Hezbollah flag. There's also a donation box and photos of Hezbollah leaders. And next to a photo of the Ayatollah of Iran, it says, "I don't think there is anything better in front of God than helping other people." Inside, the shelves are stocked with discounted Lebanese staples, rice, cooking oil, pickled vegetables, many of them imported from Iran and Syria, Hezbollah's allies in the axis of resistance. There are kitchen appliances and Iranian non-alcoholic beer. Some people here are stocking up, worried about the looming war with Israel and thankful for the discounted goods amid Lebanon's dire financial crisis. Hezbollah gives Harb and thousands of other needy families special cards that give them the right to shop here. She says the card gives access to groceries and also helps with medication and clothes for children. And Hezbollah even helped with her cancer treatment. This sort of patronage is a feature of Lebanon's sectarian political system, aimed at keeping the peace by dividing government positions by sect, and it's kept the state weak. But Bashar Saadeh says Hezbollah doesn't need the weak state.
So I wouldn't say this is in their interest to have the weak state. I think it's because the state is irremediably weak because of so many issues that we can talk about. Hezbollah plays with that, so it has to accommodate with that.
So well that Hezbollah and its allies hold 60 seats in the Lebanese parliament, despite declining support in the May 2022 elections. And Saadeh says,
it is deeply, organically linked to the Lebanese population. And more importantly, the resistance idea is here to stay. Way after anything happens in this war, way after the outcome of this war, it's something that is deeply ingrained in Lebanese psyche.
Not everyone here in Lebanon supports Hezbollah and its form of resistance. But in the past, military conflicts with Israel have only bolstered support for the Party of God. And decades of war in the region has shown military might is rarely able to conquer ideologies of resistance.
Hezbollah is here to stay.
For the world, I'm Rebecca Collard in Beirut.
5, 4, 3, we have ignition.
There is some pretty big space news today.
And liftoff of the first United Launch Alliance Vulcan rocket.
The first commercial mission to the moon blasted off early this morning from Florida. This is also the first U.S. lunar landing attempt in more than 50 years. The uncrewed Peregrine lander is also carrying both NASA and commercial cargo, including human remains. They are set to be deposited on the surface of the moon. The Navajo Nation has objected to this lunar burial because they see the moon as sacred, which made me wonder who exactly decides what happens on the moon. Mark Sundahl is a professor of law at Cleveland State University. Mark, I want to start with just the basics here. What is the purpose of this mission?
This mission, although it may be the first time that your listeners hear of it, is actually the culmination of a many-year effort of NASA and the private space industry to develop a lunar industry, a lunar segment to the space industry. And that was done with partnership through NASA, which provided funding, but also just an opportunity to collaborate to provide the services that NASA needs. And so NASA's policy in this program, this public-private partnership program, has really paid off, as we saw today.
So this is part of a long-term trend of NASA moving to using commercial spacecraft instead of their own. What makes this different than a NASA mission? What can a private company do that a NASA mission couldn't?
One of the reasons why NASA has been pivoting towards private service providers and building a market in private service providers is that you get all of the benefits of capitalism and competition in the industry. So these companies are able to innovate. They're much more nimble than the federal government could ever be, and also provide other benefits to the market, such as firm and transparent pricing, which in the past wasn't available.
So if we're entering an age when private companies are the ones landing on the moon instead of, you know, government-run agencies, who decides what is allowed to happen there?
The private activity in space is overseen by a collection of agencies. If you want to launch a rocket, you need a launch license, or it's now called an operator's license, from the FAA, Office of Commercial Space Transportation. So that is the agency. And it is a thorough process. Believe me, it's not, the government does not want to easily license people to light off a rocket from their backyard. It's ultra hazardous, clearly. And so there's a good deal of process that's involved in it to ensure the safety of the public, the safety to the environment, the compliance with international law. And so it's really a quite strict oversight.
Are launches in other countries governed by agencies in other countries? And then tell me more about international law here.
So, yes, every country that has private space activity needs to have an agency overseeing it to issue licenses. The first principle of space law is that it is open to free use by all peoples and all countries. And there are no restrictions on its use. That's why you don't need any permission to fly over any city in this world. Any country can fly a satellite and look at any other country. Hand in hand with that is that no country owns outer space. no country can assert sovereignty over the moon. It can't be our 51st state or a new province of China. So, it doesn't belong to the Navajo either. There are some guiding principles of behavior, of responsible, reasonable behavior. One, that countries are to avoid harmful interference. And the other is that when you act in outer space, and this really goes to the heart of the Navajo question, you should operate with due regard to the interests of other states. And we should do that, I believe, with the Navajo and have a conversation about it. Space law has been in effect since the 60s. It's not a new area of the law. It's very well rooted, very well respected, ultimately enforced by the International Court of Justice.
So what do you see as the future of commercial missions to the moon and beyond?
The future is the moon village. The idea of a moon village is to invite the entire world to join the village, whether it's a governmental agency or a private company. And so I see the world moving into a new era of international cooperation in space, and hopefully a long and peaceful era in space.
An idyllic view of the potential future on the moon. Mark Sundahl is a professor of law at Cleveland State University. He joined us from Cleveland, Ohio. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Now, NASA is closely associated with Cape Canaveral in Florida, but its headquarters is in Washington, D.C. And the nearby Goddard Space Flight Center is where much of NASA's research is carried out. The facility attracts talent from all over the world, especially Latin America. From WAMU in Washington, Hector Alejandro Arzate reports.
Bea Gallardo-Lacourt has a cubicle and a desk in her office, but unlike most people, her work is out of this world.
So I am a space physicist. I do research on the Aurora Borealis or the Aurora Australis, both of them.
As a researcher at NASA's Goddard Space Flight Center, it's her job to study phenomena like the aurora, which is also called the Northern Lights in our hemisphere.
When is the best time to see the aurora? That's a question that I usually
get.
Yes,
tell me.
Winter, of course. If you go to Alaska in February or March, you should see beautiful aurora.
But Gallardo-Lacourt knows way more than the best place to see those green lights on display. Her research focuses on the interactions between the Earth's magnetic field and solar wind. It's called space weather, and it can produce a dynamic plasma physics environment around our planet.
That's really, really important for every aspect of life. I cannot even imagine something that will not be impacted now if we don't understand what is going on around Earth.
And she says that's part of what inspires her, both the beauty of space and its impact here on Earth.
Initially, I wanted to be an astronomer, but it seemed so far away, everything that was observed, that I wanted to study something that will have more impact in society. And to me, space physics makes exactly that.
Gallardo-Lacourt's fascination with the stars began as a kid in her home country of Chile. In some parts, she says, the altitude and dry air makes the atmosphere really clear. It's so ideal that half of the world's major telescopes and astronomical infrastructure is there. In a way, studying space physics is part of her heritage.
And I remember lying down on the ground when I was a kid and looking at the sky. And I think Chile is just one example. Latin America is beautiful. The amount of nature and the contact with nature that the culture have is very unique.
Rob Garner, the news chief at Goddard Space Flight Center, took me on a tour of the 1,200-acre campus where Gallardo-Lacourt and about 10,000 other people work on a given day.
A little less than three times the size of Disneyland in California, but all deference due to the amusement park, the rides here can be a little bit more intense.
While you won't find the astronaut program that you're probably familiar with, Goddard is where much of the communication and testing gets done for technology, like the James Webb Space Telescope and the upcoming Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. But that's not all that happens at Goddard.
There is a very famous quote that we have here where the astronaut's heartbeat goes through NASA Goddard first.
That's Rosa Avalos Warren, who manages human spaceflight for NASA's new program to the moon, Artemis. Last year, she was on console to provide communication and navigation services for teams across the country during the first mission, a test flight into lunar orbit before returning to Earth.
And liftoff of Artemis 1.
we rise together back to the moon and beyond.
And that's just the beginning.
Artemis 2 will also lead the path for Artemis 3, which is a mission that will take the first woman and the first person of color to the moon.
That's a big deal for Avalos Warren. She was born in Peru and always had an interest in math and science. But it was the loss of the space shuttle Columbia and its seven astronauts in 2003 that changed her trajectory.
That inspired me to work for NASA and to prevent from a mishap in a similar magnitude from happening in the future.
Like many of her colleagues, Avalos Warren says it's an honor to work at NASA and that hopefully they can inspire future generations to make the next giant leap. For the world, I'm Héctor Alejandro Arzate.
This is The World. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Tattoos have long been part of the culture of the Inuit people native to the Arctic regions. They typically mark a ceremonial rite of passage. But the Inuit custom of tattoos in Greenland was lost during centuries of Danish colonialism. The World's Joshua Koh met members of the Greenlandic Inuit diaspora living in Denmark who are reclaiming traditional tattoos in a quest to heal old wounds and connect with their identity.
I'm visiting tattoo artist Maya Sealuk Jakobsen at her home on the Danish island of Fyn. Part of her house doubles as her tattoo studio. I was expecting to see electric tattoo machine pens and hear the buzzing of their needles. Instead, Sealuk Jakobsen shows me a very different set of tools. A needle fashioned from a bird's rib, another made out of copper. The threads that she uses are made of ligaments, harvested from a caribou's leg. Others are from the esophagus of a seal. What does thread have to do with tattoos? I'll explain that in a moment. But as for the ink...
Well, traditionally we would use soot and some kind of melted fat or urine or spit. We don't do that anymore.
Sealuk Jakobsen brushes back her dyed blonde bangs to show me a tattoo in the center of her forehead.
It's literally just a big V, which goes from between my eyebrows and fans out on the forehead. The point is between my eyebrows. And it is a greeting to Melina and Eningak, which are the sky spirits.
The sky spirits she refers to are central to Greenland's indigenous mythology. For Inuit, tattoos carry a deep spiritual significance, she explains. Sealuk Jakobsen is a member of the small Greenlandic Inuit community living in Denmark, a group that often feels marginalized by Danes. Greenland was a Danish colony until 1953. Today, it's an autonomous territory. Over the past 12 years, Sealuk Jakobsen has led a tattoo revival, drawing on research she's compiled from across the Arctic's Inuit communities. Like many of her clients, she is both Inuk and Danish.
They see themselves in the mirror after getting tattooed, and they are kind of saying, like, I see me, I recognize me, I was supposed to have looked like this the whole time, I knew I looked like this. And that's very powerful.
But to reconstruct these traditional practices, she used her own skin as a testing ground.
So my right leg is kind of like my test area. I have tested a lot of methods and different soot.
There are many reasons people get tattoos. Sealuk Jakobsen says that some are intended for healing. That was the case for Karsten Heilman, one of Sealuk Jakobsen's clients. When I met him in the Danish city of Aalborg, he rolled up his sleeves.
My tattoos is on my wrist, both wrists, and they are like a cross mark, like an X, not like a Christian cross, but X cross.
He says he got them as a gift from the tattoo artist after a series of difficulties. After he lost his job in Greenland, he came to Denmark, where he found himself struggling with drug addiction and homelessness. He's since moved forward and became an active leader in Aalborg's Inuit community.
After this stress and depression and all this, somehow I felt that my cross markings was also part of me all the time. They protect me through this state of my life.
Heilman got these tattoos from Siuluk Jakobsen the traditional way, known as subdermal stitching. The Inuit tattoos were created by pulling the ink through the skin using a copper or bone needle and thread. In Heilman's case, Siuluk Jakobsen used a steel needle, approved for tattooing in Denmark. But the method was the same.
It was an amazing process because it was like kind of a ritual. It was very kind of spiritual. It's like I got something for my people. It hurts a lot. There's some pain, but pain can also be a good thing, kind of. I don't know how to say it, but it was like I didn't scream or cry. I have joy in it.
It's the kind of reaction that Siuluk Jakobsen hears often.
Something happens when these patterns that are up to 4,000 years old, they get under your skin, and the spirit of these patterns meets the spirits of the ancestors in your body.
These patterns have existed in Greenland for centuries. Inuit tattooing practices were passed down from one generation to the next. But when Christian missionaries arrived from Norway and Denmark in the 1700s, the practice was discouraged. Eventually, the exact meanings and methods were lost. But these tattoo traditions survived elsewhere in the Arctic, in the indigenous communities of Canada, Alaska, and Siberia. But you won't see a lot of these designs in Denmark, even among Inuit who live here. One obstacle is the law. It's illegal here to tattoo the face, neck, and hands. And that puts Siuluk Jakobsen in a difficult position. She says she asked government officials for a legal exception for Inuit face and hand tattoos.
But it didn't happen. We're too few. They asked me, like, so how many people a year are getting tattooed? And I was like, well, I don't know, maybe 100. And the paperwork is too much for 100 people.
But she says they feel it's the way to connect with their Greenlandic roots.
The new generation showed that they are interested in the old ways of doing things. Also, a lot of the new generation are more interested in their culture.
Heilman recently received new tattoos on his left hand. One is known as a willow amulet, and the other on the knuckle of his thumb is a single dot, said to be an opening into another universe. Like the previous time in his life that he struggled, these tattoos represent healing, this time from cancer. They were a gift from Siuluk Jakobsen, after doctors declared that he was cancer-free. For The World, I'm Joshua Koh.
If your New Year's resolution is to do a better job tidying up around the house, a man in Wales can offer an unusual suggestion. Get a mouse. You heard that right. Rodney Holbrook says he started noticing small items in his shed that had moved overnight. So he set up a camera on his workbench. The night vision video shows a mouse scurrying back and forth with string and clothespins, nuts and bolts, collecting everything in a little box. Holbrook tells the BBC he stopped straightening up in the evening so the mouse would have more to do each night. His best guess is the mouse is using the stockpile to hide nuts and food. And we leave you with that tidy note on this Monday. The World comes to you each weekday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at GBH in Boston. You can find us online anytime at theworld.org. I'm Carolyn Beeler. Be good to each other out there and join us back here tomorrow. From PRX.